You do not flatter him. I scarcely know him. I think I have seen him 3 times in my life. All I know relating to him is through Busoni and himself. He was telling me this morning that, tired of letting his property lie dormant in Italy, which is a dead nation, he wished to find a method either in France or England of multiplying his millions. But remember that though I place great confidence in Busoni, I am not responsible for this.
Never mind. Accept my thanks for the client you have sent me. It is a fine name to inscribe on my lists, and my cashier was quite proud of it when I explained to him who the Cavalcanti were. By the way, this is merely a simple question. When these kind of people marry their sons, do they give them any fortune?
Oh, that depends upon circumstances. I know an Italian prince rich as a gold mine, one of the noblest families in Tuscany, who, when his sons married according to his wish, gave them millions, and when they married against his consent, merely allowed them 30 crowns a month. Should Andrea marry according to his father's views, he will perhaps give him 1, 2, or 3 millions. For example, supposing it were the daughter of a banker, he might take an interest in the house of the father-in-law of his son. Then again, if he disliked his choice, the major takes the key, double locks his coffer, and Master Andrea would be obliged to live like the son of a Parisian family by shuffling cards or rattling the dice.
That boy will find out some Bavarian or Peruvian princess. He will want a crown and an immense fortune.
No, these grand lords on the other side of the Alps frequently marry into plain families. Like Jupiter, they like to cross the race.
But do you wish to marry Andrea, my dear Monsieur Danglars, that you are asking so many questions?
Ma foi, said Danglars, it would not be a bad speculation, I fancy, and you know I am a speculator.
You are not thinking of Mademoiselle Danglars, I hope.
You would not like poor Andrea to have his throat cut by Albert.
Albert, repeated Danglars, shrugging his shoulders.
Ah, yes.
He would care very little about it, I think.
But he is betrothed to your daughter, I believe.
Certainly. Monsieur de Morcerf and I have talked about this marriage, but Madame de Morcerf and Albert...
You do not mean to say that it would not be a good match.
Indeed, I imagine that Mademoiselle Danglars is as good as Monsieur de Morcerf.
Mademoiselle Danglars' fortune will be great, no doubt, especially if the telegraph should not make any more mistakes.
Oh, I do not mean her fortune only. But tell me,
what?
Why did you not invite Monsieur and Madame de Morcerf to your dinner?
I did so, but he excused himself on account of Madame de Morcerf being obliged to go to Dieppe for the benefit of sea air.
Yes, yes, said Danglars, laughing. It would do her a great deal of good.
Why so?
Because it is the air she always breathed in her youth.
Monte Cristo took no notice of this ill-natured remark.
But still, if Albert be not so rich as Mademoiselle Danglars, said the Count, you must allow that he has a fine name.
So he has. But I like mine as well.
Certainly your name is popular and does honor to the title they intended to adorn you with. But you are too intelligent not to know that according to a prejudice too firmly rooted to be exterminated, a nobility which dates back 5 centuries is worth more than one that can only reckon 20 years.
And for this very reason, said Danglars, with a smile which he tried to make sardonic, I prefer Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti to Monsieur Albert de Morcerf.
Still, I should not think the Morcerfs would yield to the Cavalcanti.
The Morcerfs? Stay, my dear Count, said Danglars. You are a clever man, are you not?
I think so.
And you understand heraldry? A little? Well, look at my coat of arms. It is worth more than Morcerf's.
Why so?
Because, though I am not a baron by birth, my real name is at least Danglars.
Well, what then?
While his name is not Morcerf.
How? Not Morcerf?
Not the least in the world.
Go on.
I have been made a baron, so that I actually am one. He made himself a count, so that he is not one at all.
Impossible.
Listen, my dear count. Monsieur de Morcerf has been my friend, or rather my acquaintance, during the last 30 years. You know I have made the most of my arms, though I never forgot my origin.
A proof of great humility or great pride, said Monte Cristo.
Well, when I was a clerk, Morcerf was a mere fisherman.
And then he was called Fernand. Only Fernand?
Fernand Mondego.
You are sure?
Pardieu, I have bought enough fish of him to know his name.
Then why did you think of giving your daughter to him?
Because Fernand and Danglars, being both parvenus, both having become noble, both rich, are about equal in worth, excepting that there have been certain things mentioned of him that were never said of me.
What?
Oh, nothing.
Ah, yes. What you tell me recalls to mind something about the name of Fernand Mondego. I have heard that name in Greece.
In conjunction with the affairs of Ali Pasha?
Exactly so.
This is the mystery, said Danglars. I acknowledge I would have given anything to find it out.
It would be very easy if you much wished it.
How so?
Probably you have some correspondent in Greece.
I should think so.
At Janina?
Everywhere.
Well, write to your correspondent in Janina and ask him what part was played by a Frenchman named Fernand Mondego in the catastrophe of Ali Tebelin.
You are right, exclaimed Danglars, rising quickly. I will write today.
Danglars rushed out of the room and made but one leap into his coupé. 68. The Office of the Procureur du Roi. Let us leave the banker driving his horses at their fullest speed and follow Madame Danglars in her morning excursion. We have said that at 12:30 Madame Danglars had ordered her horses and had left home in the carriage. She directed her course towards the Faubourg Saint-Germain, went down the Rue de Seine, and stopped at the Passage du Pont Neuf. She descended and crossed the passage. She was very plainly dressed, as would be the case with a woman of taste walking in the morning. At the Rue Guénégaud, she called a fiacre and directed the driver to drive to the Rue d'Allée. As soon as she was seated in the coach, she drew from her pocket a very thick black veil, which she tied on to her straw bonnet. She then replaced the bonnet and saw with pleasure in a little pocket mirror that her white complexion and brilliant eyes were alone visible. The fiacre crossed the Pont Neuf and entered the Rue d'Allée by the Place Dauphine. The driver was paid as the door opened, and stepping lightly up the stairs, Madame Danglars soon reached the Salle de Pas Perdu. There was a great press of people in Monsieur de Villefort's antechamber, but Madame Danglars had no occasion even to pronounce her name. The instant she appeared, the doorkeeper rose, came to her, and asked whether she was not the person with whom Monsieur le Procureur du Roi had made an appointment, and, on her affirmative answer being given, he conducted her by a private passage to Monsieur de Villefort's office. The magistrate was seated in an armchair, writing, with his back towards the door. He heard it open, and the doorkeeper pronounced the words, "Walk in, madame," and then reclose it without moving. But no sooner had the man's footsteps ceased than he started up, drew the bolts, closed the curtains, and examined every corner of the room. Then, when he had assured himself that he could neither be seen nor heard, and was consequently relieved of doubts, he said,
"Thanks, madame. Thanks for your punctuality.
and he offered a chair to Madame Danglars, which she accepted, for her heart beat so violently that she felt nearly suffocated.
"It is a long time, madame," said the procureur du roi,
describing a half-circle with his chair so as to place himself directly opposite to Madame Danglars.
"It is a long time since I had the pleasure of speaking alone with you, and I regret that we have only now met to enter upon a painful conversation. Nevertheless, sir, you see, I have answered your first appeal, although certainly the conversation must be much more painful for me than for you. When I look at this room, whence so many guilty creatures have departed trembling and ashamed, when I look at that chair before which I now sit trembling and ashamed, oh, it requires all my reason to convince me that I am not a very guilty woman, and you a menacing judge."
Vivor dropped his head and sighed.
"And I," he said, "I feel that my place is not in the judge's seat, but on the prisoner's stool."
"You?" said Madame Danglars.
"Yes, I." "I think, sir, you exaggerate your situation," said Madame Danglars,
whose beautiful eyes sparkled for a moment.
"The paths of which you were just speaking have been traced by all young men of ardent imaginations. Besides the pleasure, there is always remorse from the indulgence of our passions. And after all, what have you men to fear from all this? The world excuses and notoriety ennobles you."
"Madame," replied Villefort, "you know that I am no hypocrite, or at least that I never deceive without a reason. If my brow be severe, it is because many misfortunes have clouded it. If my heart be petrified, it is that it might sustain the blows it has received. I was not so in my youth. I was not so on the night of the betrothal, when we were all seated round a table in the Rue de Cour at Marseille. But since then everything has changed in and about me. I am accustomed to brave difficulties, and in the conflict to crush those who, by their own free will or by chance, voluntarily or involuntarily, interfere with me in my career. It is generally the case that what we most ardently desire is as ardently withheld from us by those who wish to obtain it, or from whom we attempt to snatch it. Thus the greater number of a man's errors come before him disguised under the specious form of necessity. Then, after error has been committed in a moment of excitement, of delirium, or of fear, we see that we might have avoided and escaped it. The means we might have used, which we in our blindness could not see, then seem simple and easy, and we say, 'Why did I not do this instead of that?' Women, on the contrary, are rarely tormented with remorse, for the decision does not come from you. Your misfortunes are generally imposed upon you, and your faults the result of others' crimes."
"In any case, sir, you will allow," replied Madame Danglars, "that even if the fault were alone mine, I last night received a severe punishment for it."
"Poor thing," said Villefort, pressing her hand. "It was too severe for your strength, for you were twice overwhelmed, and yet..."
"Well?"
"Well, I must tell you. Collect all your courage, for you have not yet heard all."
"Ah," exclaimed Madame Danglars, alarmed, "what is there more to hear?"
"You only look back to the past, and it is indeed bad enough. Well, picture to yourself a future more gloomy still, certainly frightful, perhaps sanguinary."
The Baroness knew how calm Villefort naturally was, and his present excitement frightened her so much that she opened her mouth to scream, but the sound died in her throat.
"How has this terrible past been recalled?" cried Villefort. "How is it that it has escaped from the depths of the tomb and the recesses of our hearts, where it was buried, to visit us now like a phantom?"
"Alas," said Hermine, "doubtless it is chance."
"Chance!" replied Vifor. No. No, madame, there is no such thing as chance.
Oh, yes. Has not a fatal chance revealed all this? Was it not by chance the Count of Monte Cristo bought this house? Was it not by chance he caused the earth to be dug? Is it not by chance that the unfortunate child was disinterred under the trees, that poor innocent offspring of mine, which I never even kissed, but for whom I wept many, many tears? Ah, my heart clung to the Count when he mentioned the dear spoil found beneath the flowers.
Well, no, madame. This is the terrible news I have to tell you, said Vifor in a hollow voice. No, nothing was found beneath the flowers. There was no child disinterred, no. You must not weep, no, you must not groan, you must tremble.
What can you mean? Asked Madame Danglars, shuddering.
I mean that Monsieur de Monte Cristo, digging underneath these trees, found neither skeleton nor chest, because neither of them was there.
Neither of them there? Repeated Madame Danglars, fixing upon him her eyes, which, by their fearful dilation, indicated how much she was alarmed.
No, said Vifor, burying his face in his hands. No, 100 times, no.
Then you did not bury the poor child there, sir? Why did you deceive me? Where did you place it? Tell me, where?
There. But listen to me, listen, and you will pity one who has for 20 years alone borne the heavy burden of the grief I am about to reveal, without casting the least portion upon you.
Oh, you frighten me, but speak, I will listen.
You recollect that sad night when you were half expiring on that bed in the red damask room, while I, scarcely less agitated than you, awaited your delivery. The child was born, was given to me, without movement, without breath, without voice. We thought it dead.
Madame Danglars moved rapidly, as though she would spring from her chair, but Vifor stopped and clasped his hands as if to implore her attention.
"We thought it dead," he repeated. "I placed it in the chest, which was to take the place of a coffin. I descended to the garden, I dug a hole, and then flung it down in haste. Scarcely had I covered it with mould when the arm of the Corsican was stretched towards me. I saw a shadow rise, and at the same time a flash of light. I felt pain. I wished to cry out, but an icy shiver ran through my veins and stifled my voice. I fell lifeless and fancied myself killed. Never shall I forget your sublime courage when, having returned to consciousness, I dragged myself to the foot of the stairs where, expiring yourself, you came to meet me. We were obliged to keep silent upon the dreadful catastrophe. You had the fortitude to regain the house assisted by your nurse. A duel was the pretext for my wound. Though we scarcely expected it, our secret remained in our keeping alone. I was taken to Versailles. For 3 months I struggled with death. At last, as I seemed to cling to life, I was ordered to the south. My recovery lasted 6 months. I never heard you mentioned, and I did not dare inquire for you. When I returned to Paris, I learned that, widow of Monsieur de Nogent, you had married Monsieur Danglars. What had been the subject of my thoughts ever since consciousness had returned to me? Always the same. Always the child's corpse, which every night in my dreams, rising from the earth, fixed itself above the grave with a menacing look and gesture. I inquired immediately on my return to Paris. The house had not been inhabited since we left it, but it had just been let for 9 years. I found the tenant. I pretended that I disliked the idea of a house belonging to my wife's father and mother passing into the hands of strangers. I offered to pay them for yielding up the lease. They demanded 6,000 francs. I would have given 10,000. I would have given 20,000. I had the money with me. I made the tenant sign the cancelling deed, and when I had obtained what I so much wanted, I galloped to Auteuil. No one had entered the house since I had left it. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I ascended into the red room and waited for night. There, all the thoughts which had disturbed me during my year of constant agony occurred with double force. The Corsican, who had declared the vendetta against me, who had followed me from Nîmes to Paris, who had hid himself in the garden, who had struck me, had seen me dig the grave, had seen me inter the child. He might become acquainted with your person. Nay, he might even then have known it. Would he not one day make you pay for keeping this terrible secret? Would it not be a sweet revenge for him when he found I had not died from the blow of his dagger? It was therefore necessary before everything else and at all risks that I should cause all traces of the past to disappear, that I should destroy every material vestige. Too much reality would always remain in my recollection. It was for this I had annulled the lease. It was for this I had come. It was for this I was waiting. Night arrived. I allowed it to become quite dark. Listen, Hermine, I consider myself as brave as most men, but when I drew from my breast the little key of the staircase which I had found in my coat, that little key we both used to cherish so much, which you wished to have fastened to a golden ring, when I opened the door and saw the pale moon shedding a long stream of white light on the spiral staircase like a spectre, I leaned against the wall and nearly shrieked. I seemed to be going mad. At last I mastered my agitation. I descended the staircase step by step. The only thing I could not conquer was a strange trembling in my knees. I grasped the railings. If I had relaxed my hold for a moment, I should have fallen. I reached the lower door. Outside this door, a spade was placed against the wall. I took it and advanced towards the thicket. I had provided myself with a dark lantern. In the middle of the lawn I stopped to light it. Then I continued my path. It was the end of November. All the freshness of the garden had disappeared. The trees were nothing more than skeletons with their long bony arms, and the dead leaves sounded on the gravel under my feet. My terror overcame me to such a degree as I approached the thicket that I took a pistol from my pocket and armed myself. I fancied continually that I saw the figure of the Corsican between the branches. I examined the thicket with my dark lantern. It was empty. I cast my eyes all round. I was indeed alone. No noise disturbed the silence of the night but the owl, whose piercing cry seemed as if calling up the phantoms of the night. I tied my lantern to a forked branch I had remarked a year before at the precise spot where I stopped to dig the hole. The grass had grown very thickly there during the summer, and when autumn arrived, no one had been there to mow it. Still, one place less covered attracted my attention. It evidently was there I had turned up the ground. I returned to work. The hour then for which I had been waiting during the last year had at length arrived. How I worked! How I hoped! How I sounded every piece of turf, thinking to find some resistance to my spade, but no, I found nothing, though I had made a hole twice as large as the first. I thought I had been deceived, had mistaken the spot. I turned round, I looked at the trees, I tried to recall the details which had struck me at the time. I recollected that I was stabbed just as I was trampling the ground to fill up the hole. While doing so, I had leaned against a false ebony tree.
Behind me was an artificial rock intended to serve as a resting place for persons walking in the garden. In falling, my hand, relaxing its hold of the tree, felt the coldness of this stone. On my right I saw the tree, behind me the rock. I stood in the same attitude and threw myself down. I rose and again began digging and enlarging the hole. Still I found nothing. Nothing. The chest was no longer there.
The chest? No longer there? Murmured Madame Danglars, choking with fear.
Think not I contented myself with this one effort, continued Villefort. No, I searched the whole thicket. I thought the assassin, having discovered the chest and supposing it to be a treasure, had intended carrying it off, but, perceiving his error, had dug another hole and deposited it. But there was nothing. Then the idea struck me that he had not taken these precautions and had simply thrown it in a corner. In the last case, I must wait for daylight to resume my search. I regained the room and waited.
Oh, heaven!
When daylight dawned, I went down again. My first visit was to the thicket. I hoped to find some traces which had escaped me in the dark. I had turned up the earth over a surface of more than 20 feet square and a depth of 2 feet. A labourer would not have done in a day what occupied me an hour. But I could find nothing, absolutely nothing. Then I renewed the search. Supposing it had been thrown aside, it would probably be on the path which led to the little gate. But this examination was as useless as the first, and with a bursting heart I returned to the thicket, which now contained no hope for me.
"Oh!" cried Madame Danglars. "It was enough to drive you mad."
"I hoped for a moment that it might," said Villefort, "but that happiness was denied me. However, recovering my strength and my ideas, why," said I, "should that man have carried away the corpse?"
"But you said," replied Madame Danglars, "he would require it as a proof."
"Ah, no, madame, that could not be. Dead bodies are not kept a year. They are shown to a magistrate and the evidence is taken. Now nothing of the kind has happened."
"What then?"
asked Hermine, trembling violently. "Something more terrible, more fatal, more alarming for us. The child was perhaps alive, and the assassin may have saved it."
Madame Danglars uttered a piercing cry, and seizing Villefort's hands, exclaimed,
"My child was alive?" said she. "You buried my child alive, sir? You were not certain my child was dead, and you buried it? Ah!"
Madame Danglars had risen and stood before the procureur, whose hands she wrung in her feeble grasp.
"I know not. I merely suppose so, as I might suppose anything else," replied Villefort, with a look so fixed it indicated that his powerful mind was on the verge of despair and madness.
"Ha! My child! My poor child!" cried the Baroness, falling on her chair and stifling her sobs in her handkerchief.
"You understand, then, that if it were so," said Villefort, rising in his turn and approaching the Baroness to speak to her in a lower tone, "we are lost. This child lives, and someone knows it lives. Someone is in possession of our secret. And since Monte Cristo speaks before us of a child disinterred, when the child could not be found, it is he who is in possession of our secret."
"Just God! Avenging God!" murmured Madame Danglars.
Villefort's only answer was a species of groan.
"But the child, sir," repeated the agitated mother.
"How have I searched for him," replied Villefort, wringing his hands. "How have I called him in my long sleepless nights? How have I longed for royal wealth to purchase a million of secrets from a million of men and to find mine among them? At last, one day when for the 100th time I took up my spade, I asked myself again and again what the Corsican could have done with the child. Her child encumbers a fugitive. Perhaps, on perceiving it was still alive, he had thrown it into the river. Impossible! Cried Madame Danglars. A man may murder another out of revenge, but he would not deliberately drown a child. Perhaps, continued Villefort, he had put it in the foundling hospital. Oh, yes, yes! Cried the Baroness. My child is there. I ran to the hospital and learned that the same night, the night of the 20th September, a child had been brought there, wrapped in part of a fine linen napkin, purposely torn in half. This portion of the napkin was marked with half a baron's crown, and the letter H. Truly, truly, said Madame Danglars, all my linen is marked thus. Monsieur de Nargon was a baronet, and my name is Hermine. Thank God, my child was not then dead. Oh, where is it?
Villefort shrugged his shoulders. Do I know? Said he. And do you believe that, if I knew, I would relate to you all its trials and all its adventures, as would a dramatist or a novel writer? Alas, no, I know not. A woman, about 6 months after, came to claim it with the other half of the napkin. This woman gave all the requisite particulars, and it was entrusted to her.
But you should have inquired for the woman. You should have traced her.
And what do you think I did? I feigned a criminal process, and employed all the most acute bloodhounds and skilful agents in search of her. They traced her to Chalon, and there they lost her.
They lost her?
Yes, forever.
Madame Danglars had listened to this recital with a sigh, a tear, or a shriek for every circumstance.
And that is all? Said she. And you stopped there?
Oh, no, said Villefort. I never ceased to search and to inquire. However, the last 2 or 3 years I had allowed myself some respite. But now I will begin with more perseverance and fury than ever, since fear urges me, not my conscience.
But, replied Madame Danglars, the Count of Monte Cristo can know nothing, or he would not seek our society as he does.
Oh, the wickedness of man is very great, said Villefort, since it surpasses the goodness of God. Did you observe that man's eyes while he was speaking to us?
No.
But have you ever watched him carefully?
Doubtless he is capricious, but that is all. One thing alone struck me. Of all the exquisite things he placed before us, he touched nothing. I might have suspected he was poisoning us.
And you see, you would have been deceived. Believe me, that man has other projects. For that reason I wish to see you, to speak to you, to warn you against everyone, but especially against him. Tell me, cried Villefort, fixing his eyes more steadfastly on her than he had ever done before, did you ever reveal to anyone our connection?
Never to anyone.
You understand me, replied Villefort affectionately. When I say anyone, pardon my urgency, to anyone living, I mean.
Yes, yes, I understand very well, ejaculated the Baroness. Never, I swear to you.
Were you ever in the habit of writing in the evening what had transpired in the morning? Do you keep a journal?
No. My life has been passed in frivolity. I wish to forget it myself.
Do you talk in your sleep?
I sleep soundly, like a child. Do you not remember?
The colour mounted to the Baroness's face, and Villefort turned awfully pale.
It is true, said he, in so low a tone that he could hardly be heard.
Well, said the Baroness.
Well, I understand what I now have to do, replied Villefort.
In less than 1 week from this time, I will ascertain who this Monsieur de Monte Cristo is, whence he comes, where he goes, and why he speaks in our presence of children which have been disinterred in a garden."
Vifor pronounced these words with an accent which would have made the Count shudder had he heard him. Then he pressed the hand the Baroness reluctantly gave him and led her respectfully back to the door. Madame Danglars returned in another hackney coach to the passage, on the other side of which she found her carriage and her coachman sleeping peacefully on his box while waiting for her. 69. A Summer Ball. The same day, during the interview of Madame Danglars with the procureur, a travelling carriage entered the Rue du Eld, passed through the gateway of No. 27, and stopped in the yard. In a moment the door was opened and Madame de Morcerf alighted, leaning on her son's arm. Albert soon left her, ordered his horses, and having arranged his toilet, drove to the Champs-Élysées, to the house of Monte Cristo. The Count received him with his habitual smile. It was a strange thing that no one ever appeared to advance a step in that man's favour. Those who would, as it were, force a passage to his heart, found an impassable barrier. Morcerf, who ran towards him with open arms, was chilled as he drew near, in spite of the friendly smile, and simply held out his hand. Monte Cristo shook it coldly, according to his invariable practice. "Here I am, dear Count. Welcome home again. I arrived an hour since." "From Dieppe?" "No, from Tréport." "Indeed. And I am directly come to see you." "That is extremely kind of you," said Monte Cristo, with a tone of perfect indifference. "And what is the news?" "You should not ask a stranger, a foreigner, for news. I know it, but in asking for news, I mean, have you done anything for me?" "Had you commissioned me?" said Monte Cristo, feigning uneasiness. "Come, come," said Albert, "do not assume so much indifference. It is said sympathy travels rapidly, and when at Tréport I felt the electric shock. You have either been working for me or thinking of me." "Possibly," said Monte Cristo, "I have indeed thought of you, but the magnetic wire I was guiding acted indeed without my knowledge." "Indeed. Pray tell me how it happened."
"Willingly. Monsieur Danglars dined with me." "I know it. To avoid meeting him, my mother and I left town. But he met here Monsieur Andrea Cavalcanti, your Italian prince." "Not so fast. Monsieur Andrea only calls himself Count."
"Calls himself, do you say?"
"Yes, calls himself. Is he not a Count? What can I know of him?" "He calls himself so. I, of course, give him the same title, and everyone else does the same." "What a strange man you are! What next? You said Monsieur Danglars dined here?"
"Yes, with Count Cavalcanti, the Marquis his father, Madame Danglars, Monsieur and Madame de Villefort. Charming people. Monsieur de Bray, Maximilien Morel, and Monsieur de Château-Renaud.
Did they speak of me?"
"Not a word."
"So much the worse."
"Why so? I thought you wished them to forget you. If they did not speak of me, I am sure they thought about me, and I am in despair."
"How will that affect you, since Mademoiselle Danglars was not among the number here who thought of you?"
"Truly, she might have thought of you at home. I have no fear of that, or if she did, it was only in the same way in which I think of her."
"Touching sympathy. So you hate each other?" said the Count.
"Listen," said Morcerf, "if Mademoiselle Danglars were disposed to take pity on my supposed martyrdom on her account, and would dispense with all matrimonial formalities between our two families, I am ready to agree to the arrangement. In a word, Mademoiselle Danglars would make a charming mistress, but a wife, diable."
"And this," said Monte Cristo, "is your opinion of your intended spouse?"
"Yes. It is rather unkind, I acknowledge, but it is true. But as this dream cannot be realized, since Mademoiselle Danglars must become my lawful wife, live perpetually with me, sing to me, compose verses and music within 10 paces of me, and that for my whole life. It frightens me. One may forsake a mistress, but a wife, good heavens, there she must always be, and to marry Mademoiselle Danglars would be awful.
You are difficult to please, Viscount.
Yes, for I often wish for what is impossible.
What is that?
To find such a wife as my father found. Monte Cristo turned pale and looked at Albert while playing with some magnificent pistols.
Your father was fortunate, then, said he.
You know my opinion of my mother, Count. Look at her, still beautiful, witty, better than ever. For any other son to have accompanied his mother 4 days at Tréport, it would have been a complaisance, an unprofitable toil. While I return, more contented, more peaceful, shall I say more poetic, than if I had taken Queen Mab or Titania as my companion.
That is an overwhelming perfection, and you would make everyone vow to live a single life.
Such are my reasons for not liking to marry Mademoiselle Danglars. Thus I shall rejoice when Mademoiselle Eugénie perceives I am but a pitiful atom with scarcely as many 100,000 francs as she has millions.
Monte Cristo smiled.
One plan occurred to me, continued Albert. Franz likes all that is eccentric. I tried to make him fall in love with Mademoiselle Danglars, but in spite of 4 letters written in the most alluring style, he invariably answered, "My eccentricity may be great, but it will not make me break my promise." That is what I call devoted friendship, to recommend to another one whom you would not marry yourself.
Albert smiled. "Apropos," continued he, "France is coming soon, but it will not interest you. You dislike him, I think."
"I?" said Monte Cristo. "My dear Viscount, how have you discovered that I did not like Monsieur France? I like everyone." "And you include me in the expression, everyone. Many thanks."
"Let us not mistake," said Monte Cristo. "I love everyone as God commands us to love our neighbor, as Christians. But I thoroughly hate but a few. Let us return to Monsieur France d'Epinay. Did you say he was coming?"
"Yes, summoned by Monsieur de Villefort, who is apparently as anxious to get Mademoiselle Valentine married as Monsieur Danglars is to see Mademoiselle Eugénie settled. It must be a very irksome office to be the father of a grown-up daughter. It seems to make them feverish and to raise their pulse to 90 degrees until they get rid of them. But Monsieur d'Epinay, unlike you, bears his misfortune patiently. Still more, he talks seriously about the matter, puts on a white cravat, and speaks of his family. He entertains a very high opinion of Monsieur and Madame de Villefort, which they deserve, do they not?
I believe they do.
Monsieur de Villefort has always passed for a severe but a just man. There is, then, one, said Monte Cristo, whom you do not condemn like poor Danglars.
Because I am not compelled to marry his daughter, perhaps, replied Albert, laughing.
Indeed, my dear sir, said Monte Cristo, you are revoltingly foppish.
I? Foppish? How do you mean?
Yes. Pray take a cigar and cease to defend yourself and to struggle to escape marrying Mademoiselle Danglars. Let things take their course. Perhaps you may not have to retract.
Bah, said Albert, staring.
Doubtless, Monsieur le Vicomte, you will not be taken by force. And seriously, do you wish to break off your engagement?
I would give 100,000 francs to be able to do so.
Then make yourself quite happy. Monsieur Danglars would give double that sum to attain the same end.
Am I indeed so happy? Said Albert, who still could not prevent an almost imperceptible cloud passing across his brow.
But, my dear Count, has Monsieur Danglars any reason?
Ah, there is your proud and selfish nature. You would expose the self-love of another with a hatchet, but you shrink if your own is attacked with a needle. But yet Monsieur Danglars appeared delighted with you, was he not?
Well, He is a man of bad taste, and is still more enchanted with another. I know not whom. Study and judge for yourself.
Thank you. I understand. But my mother... No, not my mother, I mistake. My father intends giving a ball.
A ball at this season? Summer balls are fashionable.
If they were not, the Countess has only to wish it, and they would become so.
You are right. You know they are unmixed balls. Those who remain in Paris in July must be true Parisians. Will you take charge of our invitation to Monsieur Cavalcanti?
When will it take place?
On Saturday.
Monsieur Cavalcanti's father will be gone, but the son will be here. Will you invite young Monsieur Cavalcanti?
I do not know him, Viscount.
You do not know him?
No. I had never seen him until a few days since, and am not responsible for him.
But you receive him at your house.
That is another thing. He was recommended to me by a good abbé, who may be deceived.
Give him a direct invitation, but do not ask me to present him.
If he were afterwards to marry Mademoiselle Danglars, you would accuse me of intrigue, and would be challenging me. Besides, I may not be there myself.
Where?
At your ball.
Why should you not be there?
Because you have not yet invited me.
But I come expressly for that purpose.
You are very kind, but I may be prevented.
If I tell you one thing, you will be so amiable as to set aside all impediments.
Tell me what it is.
My mother begs you to come.
The Countess de Morcerf, said Monte Cristo, starting.
Ah, Count, said Albert, I assure you, Madame de Morcerf speaks freely to me, and if you have not felt those sympathetic fibres of which I spoke just now thrill within you, you must be entirely devoid of them, for during the last 4 days we have spoken of no one else.
You have talked of me?
Yes, that is your privilege, being a living problem.
Then I am also a problem to your mother?
I should have thought her too reasonable to be led by imagination.
A problem, my dear Count, for everyone, for my mother as well as others.
Much studied but not solved, you still remain an enigma. Do not fear.
My mother is only astonished that you remain so long unsolved.
I believe while the Countess G takes you for Lord Ruthven, my mother imagines you to be Cagliostro or Count Saint-Germain.
The first opportunity you have, confirm her in her opinion. It will be easy for you, as you have the philosophy of the one and the wit of the other.
I thank you for the warning, said the Count. I shall endeavour to be prepared for all suppositions.
You will then come on Saturday?
Yes, since Madame de Morcerf invites me.
You are very kind.
Will Monsieur Danglars be there?
He has already been invited by my father.
We shall try to persuade the great d'Aguesseau, Monsieur de Villefort, to come, but have not much hope of seeing him.
Never despair, says the proverb.
Do you dance, Count?
I dance?
Yes, you. It would not be astonishing.
That is very well before one is above 40.
No, I do not dance, but I like to see others.
Does Madame de Morcerf dance?
Never. You can talk to her. She so delights in your conversation.
Indeed. Yes, truly.
And I assure you, you are the only man of whom I have heard her speak with interest.
Albert rose and took his hat. The Count conducted him to the door.
I have one thing to reproach myself with, said he, stopping Albert on the steps.
What is it?
I have spoken to you indiscreetly about Danglars.
On the contrary, speak to me always in the same strain about him.
That is enough.
Apropos, when do you expect Monsieur d'Epernay?
5 or 6 days hence at the latest.
And when is he to be married?
Immediately on the arrival of Monsieur and Madame de Saint-Marin.
Bring him to see me.
Although you say I do not like him, I assure you I shall be happy to see him.
I will obey your orders, my lord.
Goodbye. Until Saturday, when I may expect you, may I not?
Yes, I promised you.
The Count watched Albert waving his hand to him.
When he had mounted his phaeton, Monte Cristo turned, and seeing Bertuccio, "What news?" said he. "She went to the palais," replied the steward. "Did she stay long there?" "An hour and a half." "Did she return home?" "Directly." "Well, my dear Bertuccio," said the count, "I now advise you to go in quest of the little estate I spoke to you of in Normandy." Bertuccio bowed, and as his wishes were in perfect harmony with the order he had received, he started the same evening.
70. The Inquiry. Monsieur de Villefort kept the promise he had made to Madame Danglars to endeavor to find out how the Count of Monte Cristo had discovered the history of the house at Auteuil. He wrote the same day to Monsieur de Beauvie, who, from having been an inspector of prisons, was promoted to a high office in the police, for the information he acquired, and the latter begged 2 days to ascertain exactly who would be most likely to give him full particulars. At the end of the second day, Monsieur de Villefort received the following note. "The person called Monsieur le Comte de Monte Cristo is an intimate acquaintance of Lord Wilmore, a rich foreigner who is sometimes seen in Paris, and who is there at this moment. He is also known to the Abbé Busoni, a Sicilian priest of high repute in the East, where he has done much good." Monsieur de Villefort replied by ordering the strictest inquiries to be made respecting these 2 persons. His orders were executed, and the following evening he received these details. The abbé, who was in Paris for a month, inhabited a small house behind Saint-Sulpice, composed of 1 single story over the ground floor. 2 rooms were on each floor, and he was the only tenant. The 2 lower rooms consisted of a dining room with a table, chairs, and sideboard of walnut tree, and a wainscoted parlour without ornaments, carpet, or timepiece. It was evident the abbé limited himself to objects of strict necessity. It was true the abbé preferred the sitting room upstairs, which, being furnished with theological books and parchments, in which he delighted to bury himself during whole months, was more a library than a parlour. His valet looked at the visitors through a sort of wicket, and if their countenance was unknown to him or displeased him, he replied that Monsieur l'Abbé was not in Paris, an answer which satisfied most persons, because the Abbé was known to be a great traveller. Besides, whether at home or not, whether in Paris or Cairo, the Abbé always left something to give away, which the valet distributed through this wicket in his master's name. The other room, near the library, was a bedroom. A bed without curtains, 4 armchairs, and a couch covered with yellow Utrecht velvet, composed, with a prie-dieu, all its furniture. Lord Wilmore resided in Rue Fontaine Saint-Georges. He was one of those English tourists who consume a large fortune in travelling. He hired the apartment in which he lived, furnished, passed only a few hours in the day there, and rarely slept there. One of his peculiarities was never to speak a word of French, which he, however, wrote with great purity. The day after these important particulars had been furnished to Monsieur le Procureur, a man alighted from a carriage at the corner of the Rue Férou, and, rapping at an olive-green door, asked if the Abbé Busoni were within. "No, he went out early this morning," replied the valet. "I might not always be contented with that answer," replied the visitor, "for I come from one to whom everyone must be at home. But have the kindness to give the Abbé Busoni—" "I told you he was not at home," repeated the valet. "Then, on his return, give him that card and this sealed paper. Will he be at home at 8 o'clock this evening?" "Doubtless, unless he is at work, which is the same as if he were out." "I will come again at that time," replied the visitor, who then retired. At the appointed hour, the same man returned in the same carriage, which, instead of stopping this time at the end of the Rue Férou, drove up to the green door. He knocked, and it was opened immediately to admit him. From the signs of respect the valet paid him, he saw his note had produced a good effect. "Is the abbé at home?" asked he. "Yes, he is at work in his library, but he expects you, sir," replied the valet.
The stranger ascended a rough staircase, and before a table whose surface was illumined by a lamp, whose light was concentrated by a large shade, whilst the rest of the apartment was in partial darkness, he perceived the abbé in a monk's dress, with a cowl on his head, such as was used by learned men of the Middle Ages.
"Have I the honour of addressing the Abbé Busoni?" asked the visitor.
"Yes, sir," replied the abbé. "And are you the person whom Monsieur de Beauvais, formerly an inspector of prisons, sends to me from the prefect of police?"
"Exactly, sir."
"One of the agents appointed to secure the safety of Paris?"
"Yes, sir," replied the stranger with a slight hesitation and blushing.
The abbé replaced the large spectacles which covered not only his eyes but his temples, and sitting down, motioned to his visitor to do the same.
"I am at your service, sir," said the abbé, with a marked Italian accent.
"The mission with which I am charged, sir," replied the visitor, speaking with hesitation, "is a confidential one on the part of him who fulfills it and him by whom he is employed."
The abbé bowed.
"Your probity," replied the stranger, "is so well known to the prefect that he wishes, as a magistrate, to ascertain from you some particulars connected with the public safety, to ascertain which I am deputed to see you. It is hoped that no ties of friendship or humane consideration will induce you to conceal the truth."
"Provided, sir, the particulars you wish for do not interfere with my scruples or my conscience. I am a priest, sir, and the secrets of confession, for instance, must remain between me and God, and not between me and human justice."
"Do not alarm yourself, Monsieur l'Abbé. We will duly respect your conscience."
At this moment the abbé pressed down his side of the shade, which raised it on the other, and threw a bright light on the face of the stranger, while his own remained obscured.
"Excuse me, abbé," said the envoy of the prefect of police, "but the light tries my eyes very much."
The abbé lowered the shade.
"Now, sir, I am listening. Speak."
"I will come at once to the point. Do you know the Count of Monte Cristo?"
"You mean Monsieur Zaccone, I presume."
"Zaccone? Is not his name Monte Cristo?"
"Monte Cristo is the name of an estate, or rather of a rock, and not a family name."
"Well, be it so. Let us not dispute about words. And since Monsieur de Monte Cristo and Monsieur Zaccone are the same..."
"Absolutely the same.
Let us speak of Monsieur Zaccone."
"Agreed."
"I asked you if you knew him."
"Extremely well."
"Who is he?"
"The son of a rich shipbuilder in Malta."
"I know that is the report, but, as you are aware, the police does not content itself with vague reports."
"However," replied the abbé with an affable smile, "when that report is in accordance with the truth, everybody must believe it, the police as well as all the rest."
"Are you sure of what you assert?"
"What do you mean by that question?"
"Understand, sir, I do not in the least suspect your veracity. I ask you, are you certain of it?"
"I knew his father, Monsieur Zaccone."
Ah.
"And when a child, I often played with the son in the timber yards.
But whence does he derive the title of Count?"
"You are aware that may be bought."
"In Italy?"
"Everywhere."
"And his immense riches, whence does he procure them?"
"They may not, perhaps, be so very great."
"How much do you suppose he possesses?"
"From 150 to 200,000 livres per annum."
"That is reasonable," said the visitor. "I have heard he had 3 or 4 millions.
200,000 per annum would make 4 millions of capital."
"But I was told he had 4 millions per annum."
"That is not probable."
"Do you know his island of Monte Cristo?"
"Certainly. Everyone who has returned from Palermo, from Naples, or from Rome to France by sea must know it, since he has passed close to it and must have seen it. I am told it is a delightful place. It is a rock.
And why has the Count bought a rock?
For the sake of being a Count. In Italy, one must have a county to be a Count.
You have, doubtless, heard the adventures of Monsieur Zaccone's youth.
The father's? No, the son's. I know nothing, sir.